is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
And it's a pleasure to welcome the author, Raj Rajaratnam. His new book is Uneven Justice. This is an autobiography, at the same time an analysis of Wall Street, the Justice Department these last years, especially since the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. The subplot is the plot to sink Galleon. Galleon is not a ship. It was a hedge fund at the time. And I welcome Raj, and I go to an event that is flabbergasting once you understand Raj's story. This is the Barra Task Force on Insider Trading, publishing findings January 27th, 2020, right before the pandemic. Preet Bharara was the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, an extremely powerful post in the solar system. The task force writes this: for too long, insider trading law has lacked clarity, generated confusion, and failed to keep up with the times. Without a statute specifically directed at insider trading, the law has developed through a series of fact-specific court decisions applying the general anti-fraud provisions of our security laws across a broadening set of conduct. I'll stop there because lack clarity is everything you need to understand. Raj, a good evening to you. Thank you very much. This paragraph is striking to me. What is, what was, how do we understand insider trading from the point of view of a professional? And for many years, you trained very carefully lots of people to understand what is and what is not a permissible. Good evening to you, Raj.
Good evening, John, and I'm delighted to be here. I've been an admirer of yours because you explore the truth, and you're a fighter as well, and you care about civil liberty. So let me get to your question. Number one, traditionally insider trading was if an insider of a company violated their fiduciary responsibility and traded on that stock. Over the years, this insider trading law has been interpreted differently by different prosecutors. Mr. Bharara's interpretation of insider trading laws was a novel approach when he charged me with insider trading. They said they don't have to prove that I knew that the information was tainted or came from an insider. Now, this was shocking to many legal observants. Subsequently, 5 years later, after my case and my appeal, the Second Circuit reversed Bharara's aggressive position and said the way insider trading should be, the law should be interpreted, is that the tippee, in this case the investor, should have known that the information came for a tipper and paid some benefit. So let me cut it down to sort of basic understanding. If you went to Best Buy and bought a stolen Apple TV that you didn't know was stolen, should you indict and arrest the guy who bought the Apple TV, or should you indict and charge the store owner who is buying stolen TVs? It's as simple as that. And Bharara's theory of insider trading originally was rejected by the Second Circuit, and they called it doctrinal novelty. So he pursued this insider trading with such gusto when he was under the public glare and lights and, you know, sort of drank the Kool-Aid, that I think 10 years later, when he was no longer in the public spotlight, he may have reflected and said, you know, that it's lacks clarity, and they feel sorry for the market participants.
And there is a nightmare in your story, Raj. It's October 16th, 2009. You, at the time, were accustomed to getting up extremely early in the morning in New York and going on an exercise bike where you enjoyed a moment for yourself, watching the news and getting ready for the day on Wall Street. That morning, you were surprised to hear a knock at the door. Who was it, Raj?
It was Agent B.J. Kang with several FBI guys, all in blue with yellow letters on their jackets, FBI. they came with guns drawn. And I asked them, what is this about? And they said, we'll tell you later on, get dressed, and we're going to go down to the FBI downtown headquarters. This was a shock, because if you had asked me half an hour before, 10 minutes before, what are the 100 things you worry about, insider trading was something that I was not even on that list. They tried to intimidate me by telling me that my wife looked very happy because she can spend all the money without my concurrence, and told me to, in front of my son, who was hiding under the blanket, he was 13 years old at that time, told me, you won't see your son again for 25 years.
Agent Kang said that. Agent Kang.
Yeah. Agent Kang said that. Now, as I understand it, in lots of white-collar cases, that a district attorney would ask you to come to his office with your lawyer. But the U.S. attorney here wanted to create such a big fanfare. He had just been a district attorney for only 2 months, but mine was his first big case. And he had a big press conference and invited all sorts of cameras and made me do a perp walk, which has traditionally been reserved for mafia people and violent crimes. He wanted to sway the public opinion from day one.
The public opinion at that time was informed on what you were watching on the news. This is October of 2009. The new president has been in office for 10 months. We're in the midst of what was called the Great Recession. Do you connect the atmosphere of the Great Recession and what I can report to you, Raj, all these years later, was a pall hanging over Wall Street at the time? There were many protests that eventually turned into Occupy Wall Street. Do you connect that atmosphere with the way you were treated that morning?
I think the U.S. attorney played on the public opinion. You know, after my case, he was anointed as the sheriff of Wall Street, but not a single banker who contributed, or senior banker who contributed to the financial crisis, were ever charged because Mr. Barrera focused his entire efforts on a small sector of the investment industry, the hedge fund, and got maximum publicity.
At the time of your detention by the FBI, you did not call an attorney. What was your thinking, Raj? Why didn't you call an attorney right then?
Because I didn't think that this was serious. I thought there's some misunderstanding. I would go and tell him, here are the reasons I traded what I traded. And eventually, after 3 or 4 hours of interrogation, my office called an attorney, and he called me and said, don't talk anymore. And I stopped talking. And then we went on to the bail hearing, where the government asked for a bail of $100 million, which was a record in the history of mankind, because they wanted to inflame the public even further. Now, you know, you've heard of Bernie Madoff, obviously. Bernie Madoff siphoned billions, multiple billions of dollars, and his bail was set at $10
million. Right. The Madoff story is still hanging over Wall Street at this time. Raj Rajaratnam is accused of insider trading. However, that has nothing whatsoever to do with the source of the Great Recession, which was about real estate and leverage on Wall Street. However, we're going to turn to what Raj did do at Galleon that is important to understand in the prosecution and the conviction at the time, in 2009 to 2011. The book is Uneven Justice, The Plot to Sink Galleon. Raj Rajaratnam is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with the author, Raj Rajaratnam. Uneven Justice is the book. The Plot to Sink Galleon. This is autobiography. Raj tells us early in the book that he wrote this while in federal prison. He wrote it sometimes at first an hour a day, sometimes 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours. It reads extremely well. It's upsetting. It's like you're trapped in a Camus story. You can't get out. You know that bad things are ahead, and you can't believe they don't turn it off at this point. So let's go back to something that I think is pertinent to the story, which is that Raj is born in what he describes as the paradox of Sri Lanka. How did you get from Sri Lanka to Wall Street, Raj? I know you got to the Wharton School, but in between Sri Lanka and the Wharton School, where did you go to school? How did you grow up?
I did my early schooling in Sri Lanka, and then I went to boarding school at the age of 11 in India, and then on to England. Us Sri Lankans believe that the British education is the most rigorous education. We were a colony of the British, and so I went to a boarding school in Britain. I did my undergraduate at Sussex University in engineering. Once I completed my degree, I came to the United States to go to the Wharton School. I was interested in finance, and I thought the ideal job for me was one that would combine my engineering background and my finance background.
You were at Chase in 1983, you were at Needham in 1985, and you rose in that firm to be president at the age of 35. What was Needham at the time, Raj?
Needham was an investment banking firm focused on the technology, consumer, and healthcare sectors. I started at Needham as a technology analyst, where I was able to combine my love of engineering and my love of finance. I started as a semiconductor analyst and in 85, and that was the time when the PC was taking off. And the guts or the building block of a PC was semiconductors. And so my analysis was fun, and I was at the leading edge, and I could actually understand the technology and convert it into regular English.
You were present at the beginning, Raj. You were right there. You watched it happen. We were all still buying an IBM computer attached to a printing machine that was from some other supplier, attached to a video that was attached from another supplier, nothing like we have today. You were watching the chips get faster and faster. And then in 1996, correct me if I have it wrong, you decided to form your own company, Galleon. How did you define the mission of Galleon?
Well, the mission of Galleon was to offer investors attractive risk return by investing in the stock market, especially in the equity side of the market. By 1996, the end of 1996, I started the fund at Needham in 1992. And in 1996, I felt that being an investment manager was going to be a full-time job. So I went to my mentor and boss, George Needham, and said I would like to start my own business, much as he had started his own business 14 years ago. And when I was an analyst at Needham, I used to go to California once a month and visit with 25 companies each. I'm sorry, once a month and visit with 25 companies each time to understand what was going on. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. I wanted to see whether I could turn my skills as an analyst into an investor. And so I officially started Galleon on June 1st, 1997.
The idea of a hedge fund is what, Raj? How do you think of the trading day as a hedge fund, as opposed to an investment bank or a mutual fund?
Okay, so a hedge fund is similar to a mutual fund. They invest in the stock market. Both of us have analysts, and all of us have investors who measure us based on our returns. The difference between a hedge fund is you can either go long the market or short the market. So it gives people, or the hedge fund manager is able to protect capital in a down market better than a mutual fund who generally invest only on the long side.
The important detail here is go long and short. What does that mean, Raj, for people who have never traded the market?
For those who think, based on the analysis, a stock might go up, you go long the market. If conversely you think a stock might go down because you didn't like their new product or your customer feedback was not good, you believe they can't sustain their growth or the profitability, and you make the decision that the stock will go down. And so you bet on the short side where you can benefit when the stock goes down.
The SEC is keen on patrolling the stock market. What was its role in with a hedge fund? How did you talk to your employees about the SEC?
Well, as a hedge fund, if you were a smaller hedge fund, you did not need to register at that time with the SEC. We voluntarily registered with the SEC. We took the SEC very, very seriously. Our edge as a company was we had 35 highly trained, highly educated analysts. Our research budget was about $40 million a year. And their job was to look at subsectors of the technology industry, for example, software, semiconductors, computers, networking, so on and so forth, and connect all the dots and all the trends that we were able to gather. Now, as professional investors, whether you're a hedge fund or a mutual fund, you are regularly invited to conferences where we met one-on-one with CEOs and CFOs and senior management of companies. And we got to talk to them and ask questions and answer any questions they may have. So it was very, very deep research.
There's a quote in your telling from a commissioner at the SEC. The quote is dated May 2011. The commissioner says, "The beauty of insider trading laws is the flexibility in interpreting them." Is that something that you thought about when you founded Galleon or those early years? Because Galleon went to $7 billion by, my note says, by 2008, you were at $7 billion. Did you concern yourselves with the SEC every day? We have about 30 seconds.
Well, we had a general counsel internally at Galleon, and I didn't know that the commissioner of the SEC would gloat after my conviction and say something that is really disingenuous.
The SEC then was in the room informally as a hedge fund. Did you ever think about the FBI listening, Raj?
Well, the FBI and the SEC did an investigation of Galleon. They talked to 24 analysts at Galleon and found no wrongdoing. So then they said, "Let us wiretap this guy." And the FBI agent Kang lied on his wiretap to get the wiretap.
All right, we have a wiretap. Now we'll go to the trial, Raj, because we have the wiretap. We understand the gathering of information by the FBI and the SEC. Uneven Justice is the book, The Plot to Sink Galleon. When we come back, the trial. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
2, 3, 3, this is Dan. Dan uses Navy Federal Credit Union to save and invest. Luckily for him, Navy Federal takes the legwork out of managing his money, which gives Dan time to work on other things, like his new auctioneering hobby. If you want to be like Dan, learn about our savings and investment options at NavyFederal.org/save and invest. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission.
Bidder number 63.
Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment options are available through Navy Federal Investment Services and are not insured by NCUA.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Raj Rajaratnam. Arrested in October of 2009. On trial for 18 months before the U.S. Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara is the U.S. attorney. The prosecutors are different names, but they're all following the direction of the office. And the trial consists of a way of demonstrating to the jury what it is that Raj and I were just talking about. What is a hedge fund, long and short? And the idea of what is insider trading, which at the time was not carefully defined, as noted by Preet Bharara himself many years later in a commission in 2020. Not defined. So an old saw in law is that juries don't respond to facts. Juries respond to stories. The prosecution is wise that tells a story to the jury about what the perpetrator, what the alleged perpetrator has done. With Raj's case, I would expect it to have been testimony by people who were telling him things that were insider trading. And yet, Raj, I am flabbergasted to learn in your telling that the government called none of the names of people who were said to have passed on insider information to Galleon. Why didn't they call all those people that you spend your time investigating?
So that question requires a multifaceted answer. Number one, it was a case that was all over the newspapers, and the prosecutor wanted to win at all costs, not get the truth out. They did not call any insider, the one that was alleged to have given the tip. And if they had done, the truth would have come out. What they did was they used three witnesses, each of whom had done a crime away from Galleon, and got them to testify against me so that they could get a reduced sentence. And after my case, all three of them got parole. These witnesses were coached and coerced by the prosecution. In fact, one of the witnesses, the main witness, totally reversed his story 3 years later on the same charges, in the same circuit, with the same witnesses. And he said, I didn't give Raj any information that was useful. And the jury acquitted him. Now, if you were a prosecutor that wanted the truth, you would have gone after the star witness, Anil Kumar. Either he was telling the truth in my case, under oath, or he was telling the truth in my co-conspirators. He couldn't have it both ways. And I would submit to you that when Anil Kumar was not under the leash of the prosecutor because he had been given 2 years sentence and had served it, he told the truth.
All right, let's go right to Anil Kumar, because this is someone you knew as a friend, as a colleague, for decades. You met him at the first time at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania in 1981. You both graduated 1983. He went to work for McKinsey, an analysis firm, and you describe him as having a bland personality. What the facts support is that he had a dark side, a part of him that was ruthless, I would say amoral. Did you ever, thinking back now, Raj, did you feel at any time in your lengthy conversations with him over the years, meeting him, that he was a deceptive person, that he wanted to stab you in the back? Did you feel that?
No, I didn't feel that, John. In fact, about 2 months before my arrest, he sent me an email how amazing it was for us to reconnect and how he liked the life choices I have made. But what I had realized was he was trying to get me to be a client of McKinsey so that he could get credit for the Galleon business. What he had done over the years is shield his income in a Swiss bank account.
Right.
And that was his Achilles heel. And so to avoid jail time, he testified against me. I think he got some conscience after he was sentenced and then testified truly in my co-conspirator's case.
Right. In 2014, he testified again in a case against your younger brother. And he told the truth, and the case was dismissed. Your brother was found not guilty when he told the truth 3 years later. Now, Raj, help me. I'm an amateur. How is it not important that a major witness reversed himself 3 years later while you were incarcerated? Didn't they come to you and say, Raj, we've made a mistake?
You would think in the perfect world, and if you thought that the justice system was here to get the truth, you would do that. It's even worse. We filed an appeal saying that the major witness has recanted his story, and as you read in the book, we put his testimony against, in my case, against the testimony in my brother's case. And the government said that he must have forgotten. It was 3 years ago. But they didn't address the thing that he seemed to remember, things that happened 10 years ago. So the bigger picture here is ambitious prosecutors, and not all prosecutors are bad. I'm going to say that off the top of the, you know, at the very beginning. There is a sliver of prosecutors who are so ambitious that they bend the rules to win, because in this country, the judicial system is politicized. The district attorney is appointed by the president. They have a clear career path to either become partners in law firms, judges. The Cato Institute has shown that the best way to become a judge is to spend time as a prosecutor. Or if you look at the majority of the congressmen and senators who have a legal background, they were ex-prosecutors. So the system is politicized. And one of the reasons I wrote this book, that the prosecutors act with immunity. And if you care about civil liberties and civil social justice, I felt that I needed to bring awareness. Now, I would also like to mention at this point that not a single dollar of this book goes to me. All of it is going to a charity called evenjustice.org. And we are going to publicize how certain prosecutors bend the rules to achieve their career aspirations.
If there were rules for insider trading, what I've learned from your telling, Raj, is that there never have been rules. I mean, this is the SEC was started by Joe Kennedy, a colorful actor, but not a man that you would go to for probity. Now, there are three witnesses the government brings only to trial. Three witnesses. All these names, all these stories that I read in the Wall Street Journal, Rumi Khan, Danielle Chiesu, others, no, they don't bring them. They're the ones who originally alerted the SEC or told the SEC they were giving you privileged information. Who knows what that means? Anu Kumar, we've talked about him. Rajiv Goel, another Wharton graduate. And Adam Smith. I want to go to Adam Smith because he worked for you. And he was ready to testify in your favor. And then what happened?
So Adam Smith started soon after Galleon was closed. Adam Smith started his own firm called Rose Lane Partners. Now, I have to just mention here that not a single investor lost money or sued Galleon, because we closed the fund and gave all the money back to the investors. Adam Smith was caught trading on inside information in his new fund. The FBI had an informant call him, set him up, and he traded on that information. So Agent Kang went to him and said the same thing. Take a good look at your kids. You're not going to see them for 20, 25 years. Adam Smith's original investor was an investor that had invested with Galleon. So Adam Smith, in a panic, called the investor and said, I need to speak to you. And he told the investor from Polaris Investments what had happened. And this investor told Adam, tell the truth. Well, he called me and said, I've just had lunch with Adam Smith, and this is what Adam told me. I said, sir, please write it in a memo and send it to my lawyer, John Dowd. So we had a letter from the investor, Polaris Investments, to John Dowd, outlining the conversation he had with Adam. Well, the judge did not allow that as evidence, while he allowed wiretaps as evidence. Wiretaps in which the FBI lied, the judge said that the FBI had a reckless disregard for the truth, but he allowed the wiretaps.
Rajiv Goel, another Wharton graduate, and it involves events that date to March of 2008, another very dire month, Raj. We all remember it. At this point, the beginnings of the banking crisis are underway. And the federal government at the time, the Bush administration, is seeking to intervene in some fashion to pull together the panic that's spreading. Rajiv Goel was a man who was talking to you all the time. You take phone calls from all of your friends over the years, including you take cold calls from people who aren't your friends. It's your nature to find information. Rajiv Goel takes loans that he doesn't from you that he doesn't report to the IRS. Therefore, he's charged with income tax evasion. Is that correct, Raj?
Yes, he called me and said that his father was in hospital, that they were going to lose their apartment in Bombay, and whether I could send him some money urgently. And I, a guy that I knew for a long time from Wharton, I did that. He took that money and hid it in a Swiss bank account to evade taxes. And he also, like Anil Kumar, hid some of his income in Swiss bank accounts. So that's the hook that the FBI got him on and wanted to testify against me.
Right. And they made the case that you'd paid him for information then. Is that right?
But Rajiv Goel said that this was a loan, and he explained the reason I gave him the loan. And I could see anger on the face of the prosecution because they were trying to prove a benefit. And then Rajiv Goel testified that he may have talked about the financials, that he had no access to the financials of Intel. He may have talked to me about Intel's earnings one time in 8 years, and he didn't know whether it was the information was positive or negative. The prosecutor, in the summation to the jury, misled the jury and the court by saying, Rajiv Goel called Raj and whispered that Intel's earnings were going to be good. And if a defense lawyer, Mr. Dowd, had made the same comment, which is mislead the jury, he could be disbarred or he could be charged with perjury. This is not even-handed.
No.
The prosecution has so much power. And the single reason is there's no accountability. Today, in the New York newspapers, three Queens people from Queens, were awarded $21 million for spending decades in prison because of prosecutorial misconduct. Do you think the prosecutors were even given a slap on the wrist? This is an uneven system. And this is why I wrote the book, to create awareness and the threat to civil liberties. John, if the FBI is allowed to lie on a wiretap and the judge allows it to be admissible in court, every American, including you, should be concerned about civil liberties.
The book is Uneven Justice, The Plot to Sink Galleon. Raj Rajaratnam is the author. When we come back, whatever happened to? I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Socks are the number one most requested item at homeless shelters. Underwear second, and shirts are third. At Bombas, socks were first, made with comfortable details for everyday wearing. Then underwear and shirts too, all designed to perfectly fit. At Bombas, every item you purchase means you're donating an essential clothing item to someone in need. One comfortable clothing item for you, one donated to someone in need. Bombas, comfort for all. Get 20% off your purchase at bombas.com/comfy.
Technologists, this is your moment. Every organization out there needs you, and it's time to think about what you want. You know, the job you've always dreamed of? It's out there, and Dice, the premier career marketplace for technology professionals, can help you land it. Visit us at dice.com to learn more.
It This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Raj Rajaratnam. His autobiography, Uneven Justice, The Plot to Sink Galleon. Raj, you were 7.5 years detained in jail, federal jail. You wrote this book while incarcerated. And now, these years later, you have many lessons in here for others on Wall Street or others who are parts of families on Wall Street about what is and is not insider trading, what is or is not material non-public information, what is or is not confidential information. There's no clarity here, so I'm not going to ask you to clarify that. I'm going to look at Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney who created an atmosphere of lawman at the U.S. District for the Southern District of New York. Now, we started by talking about how Preet Bharara's own investigation of insider trading came up with no clarity. That is true everywhere now, and I understand that that's advanced the case. However, is it your measure that the government has learned from this? Is the prosecution in other U.S. attorney's offices or in other DA's offices, are they going to take to heart the fact is that they've been using language sloppily, inarticulately all these decades, and it must stop?
John, my book, I think, or I want to address something that's bigger than insider trading. It's about prosecutorial oversight and accountability and civil rights, violations of civil rights that should not be tolerated in a civic society. I love this country. The day I took the oath as an American citizen, I accepted the laws of this country. I think that a vast majority of prosecutors and the vast majority of the FBIs do a great job and are people of honest caliber and integrity. Now, so my book was written not to define what insider trading should be, but the perils of unchecked power. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I started writing this book for my children. I had no intention of publishing it. But when I went to prison, my story was not unique. There were several people there who experienced prosecutorial misconduct. And that's when I said, you know, this is bigger than Raj Rajaratnam. There are big issues here. We are a democracy. We incarcerate more people than any other civil society. We have 5% of the world's population, and we incarcerate about 20 to 25% of the population. That's just not acceptable. And we need to search within ourselves and see why is this happening. So, yes, I would love clarity. I'm sure the big technology firms like Facebook and Twitter and Google that collect information on citizens would love clarity. I'm sure that cryptocurrency participants would like clear rules, because if we don't have clear rules, an unscrupulous, ambitious prosecutor can interpret it, play his narrative on the public stage. And these are complex cases with complex issues, and the jury can be swayed.
Final question, Raj, because in working through this, I began to think of you as the Count of Monte Cristo, a man who was unjustly imprisoned and managed to, after all these years, escape and come back not for revenge, but for what we say, clarity. Is there comfort in the fact that you now get to speak out? Does that give you some compensation for all these years of having these questions unanswered?
John, I am in a good place. I know who my great friends are. In adversity, you get to know who your friends are. So I was lucky at the age of 52 to know who my friends are. I have a wonderful family that worked with me every step of the way. I have no bitterness. I'm in a place where I can help the less fortunate. And I've set up a charity called evenjustice.org to try to create an awareness and work with organizations that want there to be an even-handed justice system. I know there's bipartisan support for criminal justice reform, but most of the attention is based on police brutality on the street. What I'm saying is there's a bigger issue of brutality in the courtroom that's not visible to the average citizen.
The book is Uneven Justice, The Plot to Sink Galleon. Raj Rajaratnam, the author, it's an autobiography. And we need part two. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.